Chapter 7. The Civil War. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. Paul. 1860. After a short time in Rumney, Daniel managed somehow to acquire a house in a lovely setting above the village. Mary's health was slightly improved, but her mental health was much improved. The deep despair she had been through was behind her, and she resumed her writing, which had nearly come to a standstill in North Groton. She could see the trials she had endured as a strengthening and purifying process. She wrote in her notebook, The Heart's Unrest, in which she views the buffeting storms as the teachings of wisdom and love. Yet through the rough billows and pitiless storms, the pilot acquires his art, and thus our dear Savior by conflict forms the meek and enduring heart. These are the teachings of wisdom and love. So lean on thy Father's breast. 'Tis the fold for the lambkin, the coat of the dove, where the love of thy heart can rest. The trials that form the meek and enduring heart also develop a strength that is beyond the comprehension of the world. It is a spiritual strength that is able, despite appearances, to say to error, thus far and no farther. In her Ode to Adversity, written in Rumney, Mary refused to repeat the despair of the Groton years. Am I to conflicts new, to be inured? No, I have long the utmost wrongs endured, and drawn fresh energies from sharpest blows. Thus, from rude hammer strokes or burning heat, with each successive change, refined, complete, the gold is purged of dross and brightly glows. 1860 was a year of political turmoil over the issue of states' rights. The industrialized North was endeavoring to dictate to the agricultural South. Tempers flared and feelings ran high, while the heads of state in Washington, D.C., endeavored to steer a safe course midst such stormy waters. Southerners saw it as an infringement on their American independence, and conservatives, both North and South, were seeking for a peaceful, just solution. When the radical Republicans gained the presidential election in the fall, the South lost all hope. And on the 20th of December, South Carolina seceded from the Union. Mary Patterson was never conservative on any issue. She had been for the abolition of slavery when she lived in South Carolina, and she rushed now with her pen to the defense of the Union. Southerners were fighting for their independence, and they had able leadership. Little wonder the first several battles were defeats for the Union, even though the North was superior, both numerically and in resources. Great Britain and France were looking favorably on the Confederacy of Southern States. In the summer of 1861, General Benjamin Butler wrote a lengthy letter to the Secretary of War, which was published in the press. Mrs. Patterson, addressed a letter to General B.F. Butler, who was a native son of New Hampshire, begging him in behalf of God's behests to our nation, of its people, and the women in New Hampshire to take a firm step toward liberating slaves in our land as a sure protest for stopping the war. The measures he adopted were accomplished. But before President Lincoln began drafting the Emancipation Proclamation, Mary Patterson had a pleasant surprise. Early in October, a letter arrived addressed to Mrs. Patterson. It was in the handwriting of one David Hall, but the letter was from her son, George. George Washington Glover II, who did not get along well with his foster father, Russell Cheney, had left home and joined the army, giving his age as a year older than the 16 he had been at the time. David Hall was in his regiment and acted as amanuensis for many of the boys who wanted to write home but were illiterate. Hall had been responsible for locating George's mother for him. Mary shed tears of joy upon receipt of the letter and was proud that her son was serving the Union. A letter written by Dr. Patterson a few days after the news from George shows that Mary's health was still a major concern. Rumney, New Hampshire, October 14, 1861. Dr. Quimby, Dear Sir, I have heard that you intended to come to Concord, New Hampshire, this fall, to stop a while for the benefit of the suffering portion of our race. Do you intend? And if so, how soon? My wife has been an invalid for a number of years, is not able to sit up but a little, and we wish to have the benefit of your wonderful power in her case. If you are soon coming to Concord, I shall carry her up to you, and if you are not coming there, we may try to carry her to Portland if you remain there. Please write me at your earliest convenience and oblige. Yours truly, Dr. D. Patterson. Mary was interested in the circular that Daniel received from Dr. Quimby, but she leaned more toward Dr. Vail's Hydropathic Institute in Hill, New Hampshire, and Hill was also much closer to home than was Portland, Maine. Daniel had never been able to settle down to home life for long at a time, and with all the excitement of war, he was chafing to be off again. Shortly after the first of the year, he received an appointment from Governor Barry of New Hampshire to go to the South and disperse funds to Southerners loyal to the Union. In March, he was in Washington, enjoying his position and the social life, but his mission was cut short. Early in April, Mary received a letter from Daniel, dated April 2nd. Dear wife, you will be amazed to learn that I am in prison in the Confederate States prison, but it is so. I was taken 1 week ago today. But God alone can tell what will become of my poor sick wife, with none to care for her. Daniel had blundered into Confederate territory while sightseeing. He asked her to contact their representative in Congress on his behalf, which she did immediately. But a communication from Daniel the following month was most discouraging. May 19, 1862. Dear wife, I am now about 900 miles from home, and heaven only knows when I shall be any nearer. I did expect McClellan would cut off the southern roads and take and release us in Richmond, as he easily could have done, but his eternal tardiness has blasted that hope, and we are fixed for the war beyond a possibility of an earlier release. I hope you hear good news from George often, and that he will soon be discharged and go and take care of you, as I can do nothing for you or even for myself. Mary wrote to Franklin Pierce, seeking help for Daniel, to Dr. Quimby, seeking help for herself, and to a bird flying southward, a poem for publication. Alas, sweet bird, of fond ones reft, alone in northern climes thus left, to seek in vain through airy space some fellow warbler's resting place, and find upon the hoarse wind's song no welcome note is borne along. Then, wildly, through the skies of blue, to spread thy wings of dappled hue, as if, forsooth, this frozen zone could yield one joy for bliss that's flown. While sunward, as thine eager flight, that glance is fixed on visions bright, and grief may nestle in that breast, some vulture may have robbed its rest. But guileless as thou art, sweet thing, with melting melody thou'lt sing. The vultures scream your nerves unstrung, but birdie, 'twas a woman's tongue. I too would join thy sky-bound flight to orange groves and mellow light, and soar from earth to loftier doom, and light on flowers with sweet perfume, and wake a genial happy lay where hearts are kind and earth so gay. Oh, to the captive's call I'd sing a song of hope and freedom bring, an olive leaf I'd quick let fall, and lift our country's blackened pall, then homeward seek my frigid zone, more chilling to the heart alone. Lone as a solitary star, lone as a vacant sepulchre, yet not alone. My father's call, who marks the sparrow in her fall, attunes my ear to joys elate, the joys I'll sing at heaven's gate. In her letter to Dr. Quimby, she queried, "Can you, will you visit me at once?" She also stated, "I was getting well this spring, but my dear husband was taken prisoner of war by the Southerners, and the shock overcame me and brought on a relapse. My disease is chronic, and I have been unable to turn myself or be moved by any but my husband for 1 year at a time. I am just on the verge of such sufferings again. Do come and save me." Mary was seeking true healing. The regular schools had failed to afford her more than temporary relief. Dr. Quimby had enjoyed some favorable publicity, and though many healthy people considered him a charlatan, many sufferers turned to him with renewed hope. Mary so longed for someone who could give her hope. But Dr. Quimby did not come. He was very busy in Portland, so Mary went instead to Dr. Vail's Hydropathic Institute in Hill, New Hampshire, thus terminating her sojourn in Rumney. While the discoverer of the science of being was experiencing numerous trials. Such tribulation was also being heaped upon that portion of the earth that was preparing a place for her. Unlike any other nation in history, the United States of America began with the Constitution, guaranteeing freedom, justice, and equality to the individual, and with the greatest gift of God to humanity, the Christian religion. Woman could not bring forth the child that was to rule all nations until the earth was ready for it and had prepared the place. Such a nation had appeared as 13 states united and had asserted its protection of further advancement and progress in writing in the First Amendment to the Constitution, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble." End quote. Could this free nation stand and maintain its place in the earth? In 1862, Southerners thought the issue was states' rights. Some citizens of the North thought the great issue of their day was slavery, but it was not. The great issue at stake was the survival of the Republic of the United States of America, the place the earth had prepared for the woman's discovery. George Washington, the father of the United States, turned often to divine providence, for all else had failed to sustain him during the hard and desolate winter of 1777-78. At Valley Forge. The war for independence seemed a hopeless cause during those dark days of tribulation. But Washington was granted relief in the form of a vision, following which it was interpreted to him in these words, quote, "Son of the Republic, what you have seen is thus interpreted. Three great perils will come upon the Republic. The most fearful is the second, passing which the whole world united shall not prevail against her. Let every child of the Republic learn to live for his God, his land, and Union." End quote. His description of the perils leaves no doubt that he was involved in the first. The second was as follows. "Before me, spread out in one vast plain, lay all the countries of the world, Europe, Asia, Africa, and America. I saw rolling and tossing between Europe and America, the billows of the Atlantic Ocean. Again I heard the mysterious voice say, 'Son of the Republic, the end of the century cometh. Look and learn.' At this, the dark shadowy angel turned his face southward, and from Africa I saw an ill-omened specter approach our land. It flitted slowly and heavily over every town and city of the latter. The inhabitants presently set themselves in battle array against each other. As I continued looking, I saw a bright angel on whose brow rested a crown of light, on which was traced the word Union, bearing the American flag, which he placed between the divided nation and said, 'Remember ye are brethren. Instantly the inhabitants, casting from them their weapons, became friends once more and united around the national standard. One of the few people who saw the vital issue in 1862 was the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. He said, quote, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. I shall do less whenever I shall believe what I am doing hurts the cause. And I shall do more whenever I shall believe doing more helps the cause." End quote. By midsummer, Lincoln had drafted a plan for freeing some of the slaves and leaving others alone. On the 22nd of September, he issued a preliminary proclamation stating that in 100 days, he would free the slaves in any state, quote, "the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States," end quote. In pursuance thereof, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued January 1, 1863. The effects were far-reaching. From that point on, the issue became slavery in the popular mind. Anti-slavery sentiment ran strong in both France and Britain, and thus precluded the possibility of their assisting the Confederacy. This marked the beginning of the end of the war, which terminated when General Lee surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox on the 9th of April, 1865. The rights of man were vindicated in a single section and on the lowest plane of human life when African slavery was abolished in our land. That was only prophetic of further steps towards the banishment of a worldwide slavery found on higher planes of existence and under more subtle and depraving forms. So wrote Mrs. Eddy. But in 1862, Mrs. Patterson was almost constantly seeking freedom from the pains and suffering of the body.